Welcome to ianellis.podbean.com. I'm your host, Ian Ellis. Guys, today's episode is going to be all about enlightenment and philosophy. So if you're not into that, go ahead and skip this episode. I found a new book. I got a lot of new information, a lot of ideas that I got to process and get through. I actually don't have all my ideas in order yet. I haven't fully chewed on all of these ideas. But we're going to start here. And then maybe in a couple weeks, when I got a little bit more together in my head, I'll go over all of the exact same things again. Just in a more clarified, to the point version. Tying into this, there's a YouTuber named Curio. C-U-R-I-O. I don't know if that's how he pronounces it. He's a little gay boy. Now, I hear about the libs and the libtards a lot. If you spend time on YouTube or you watch these comedy podcasts, you've heard about the SJWs and their motherfucking agenda. Well, I've heard about them so much, I thought that I had heard from them. And then I found this kid's channel. He does video essays. And I realized I was hearing from a liberal for the first time. I had never actually heard one of them talk. Outside of, these clips where, some kid gets owned at a debate with Milo or Ben Shapiro or Sargon of Gold. You hear about the Twitter battles, but I've never heard a truly liberal, unapologetically communist person give their point of view. And this Curio kid, he's smart, he's funny, and he's creative. He's tolerable to watch. Now, his ideas are overreaching, and there are a lot of armchair philosophy, and I would just accredit to that to him being young. And as he gets older, hopefully he'll continue to grow. Hopefully he doesn't put himself in a box by making all these videos and saying, this is what I believe. Hopefully as he finds new information, his point of view will change, and he may end up being a useful and an intelligent person to pay attention to in the future. Even right now, there's tons of stuff in his video that is very, it's moving, it's intellectually challenging. I know the liberal agenda is not for most of you. I mean, this dude's so liberal that my liberal friends are like, this dude's too much. I sent this video to a couple of my friends and they're like, Ian, you trying to tell me something? What the fuck? Why you send me this little gay dude? Sorry, Curio. He made a video about, well, actually, let me go back to a different point that he made, because he has a video about, like, misogyny and comedy, and he's not necessarily talking about comedians. He's talking about Gavin McGinnis, Ben Shapiro, and Steven Crowder. I played two little clips from that on the last episode of With Apologies, where we found out that Crowder's agent is his dad, and that Gavin McGinnis's Reddit got taken over by the transgenders. The transgender community got together to troll a dude. That's pretty fucking cool. That's a pretty cool way to do a thing, rather than whining and crying and trying to get somebody canceled or taken down. They infiltrated and they took over. So he was talking about Ben Shapiro in these video clips where you see, like, Ben Shapiro owns libtard, and Ben Shapiro smashes libtard. And he pulled in people that, college students that are, like, the head of their debate team to talk about, is Ben Shapiro actually good at debating people? And they go, he is a very intelligent person, but he's actually very bad at debating. And the reason he comes across so well is most of the videos you see, it's him on a stage holding a microphone, shutting down a kid in an audience that doesn't have a microphone. And he has, his entire breadth of examples around him, and he could basically just shout this person down. And they pointed out, when Ben Shapiro actually debates adults, or when he debates people in an atmosphere where, like, you have equal time for rebuttal, it turns out he's actually not very intelligent, and he gets shut down and smashed immediately. So I find that to be useful information. Be suspicious of Ben Shapiro, if you weren't already. So he has a video about this new video game called Control. There's some cool video games out there that give you, like, a deeper view of the world. BioShock goes into, you know, Ayn Rand's ideologies and philosophies on a certain level, enough to get you curious about reading one of her books. I recommend The Virtue of Selfishness. I like about half of it. I think I like the first four chapters. Found that to be useful information. It's kind of like proto-self-help ideology, which may, well, obviously people have been trying to help themselves for centuries, hence religion and all this other shit. But the language she uses and the ideological... she comes up with a way for you to liberate yourself, and that's going to be a big theme of today's episode. And her path toward liberation, her you know, catchphrases and her quotes that would be put up on like a fucking Pinterest wall, it's kind of the foundation of the modern self-help book genre. 50 ways to improve yourself. Hustle smarter and harder. We're going to be talking about 50 Cent. I read his book, and then one of my friends read it with me. I was going to do that on this episode, but I decided I want to hold off and try and do that episode with my friend. So he's a rapper, and we'll get his side of it, and we're going to talk about how scandalous 50 is. This is the book I always wanted him to write, and it's a whole lot of him telling on himself and other people, and I can't wait to talk about it. Oh, 50. Oh, How to Rob, the book version. So, Curio. Curio is covering this video game called Control. And the game is sort of an allegory to help you learn about how you are institutionalized or programmed by society. And it focuses on authority and the police, and understanding like how much we take for granted or don't think about the power that they have over us and our lives, all the ways we conform without realizing we're even conforming to something. Alright, back to Curio and control. I gotta break this up. I have a lot of notes. I found a book which may be the Rosetta Stone to kind of pull all these different ideas I've always had together. Throughout my life, I've had moments where I get a little piece of information and it feels like a peek behind the curtain, and you think, oh my god, I've seen the whole thing, and then it turns out it's just a piece of the puzzle. And I found all these different little pieces of the puzzle. Let's just go into this and we'll come back to Curio. So one of them is like the agricultural revolution. If you don't know anything about that, check out the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. So short version, humans have been on this earth as we are in this evolutionary form for about, let's say, 6,000 years. I'm going to pull these numbers out of my ass. For 4,000 of those years, I think it's longer than that, we were just hunters and gatherers that lived at the behest of nature. And then 2,000 years ago, we came up with agriculture, farming. We started growing our food. So now we're not traveling around following herds of buffalo. Now we can grow food, we can stay in one place. Once you can stay in one place, then you can begin to develop culture. Then you set up housing, you set up storage for the food, you set up borders and boundaries to protect your people, and your population is able to grow a lot faster than a population that is traveling around getting beat up by nature. Nature sucks. Don't overly romanticize the idea of being a native. There's like 58 untouched groups still in existence today. I saw a video, I wish I knew what it was called or where it was to give you a reference, but it was about native people, I think in the Amazon. They came down and wound up joining culture and society, and they talk about their experience, and it was fucking miserable, man. Like, they couldn't find food. Everything in the jungle is trying to kill you. Everything. Disease, bugs, snakes, spiders, alligators, lions, tigers, bears, cheetahs, the weather. Imagine going through all of that, and there's no hospital if you get sick. There's no warm blanket you can throw around you. If the weather just gets shitty, you pull some leaves over your head, and you sit it out and try to not be too cold. That's their whole life, 24/7. None of the comforts of the modern world. So, once you have a stable way of life, like farming, then your population of your tribe grows, and then you start having different roles. Like, there are people that can make tools, there are people that can grow the food, there are people that can harvest the food, there are people that can continue to hunt. So now you have a small economy of exchange. And you also need leadership. So then, now you have, you know, the leader, the shaman, the fucking the head of the farmers, the head of the women, politics. All of that has its origin in having an agricultural way of life. And as more and more groups adopted this, they began growing into villages and then developing trade routes. And that's the genesis of our society. Now, 500 years after that started, we developed the written language. So from from being farmers and building society from scratch, 500 years later, we develop our language into a symbolic language, and we decide to we should start writing this stuff down. Something's going on here. There's stuff to figure out. There's stuff that needs to be remembered. So they wrote the origins of our existence, and the way they wrote it, the earth was created for us to farm, because they had been farming for so long, 500 years, they forgot that there was another way of life. There was the way we do life as the people that earth was made for, farming the earth and tearing apart however we want, all of it belonging to us, all of it, us having dominion over everything. We have souls, we are made out of God, and everything else is, there's no difference between a cow and a rock and a beautiful bird. All of that is just mindless stuff that we can kill and torture or wipe out of existence in any way we see fit. We're not part of the ecological existence. That's just a gift that was made for us. That got written into our earliest religions. And then you jump ahead, now it'll be another, few thousand years or hundreds of years, about 1,000 years. We start getting more complex societies like the Greeks and the Romans. And they're continuing to operate on the assumption that the world was made for us and that we can do with it as we will. So it was a massive revelation for me to realize that my entire life I've taken for granted that we just have dominion over the earth. It's just made for us. There's a completely different way of perceiving reality that was never shown to me as an option. And that way is much older. And I'm not going to say it works better. I actually think what we're doing, as the technology improves, will be the right way to go. But right now we're in a really buckly phase where we're either going to figure it out or we're going to wipe ourselves off the earth. So, curio, or other pieces of the puzzle. Let's go into good and evil. I believe this is, Nietzsche's thing or Marx's thing, because it definitely relates to dialectic materialism, which is Marxism. But I think Nietzsche was the one that originally articulated this idea of good and evil are not things that inherently exist. So good is what is good to the dominant will to power. Meaning the people that are in charge, the people that have all the guns and all the money. And bad is what is bad for the dominant will to power, the game that we're playing, the pattern, the culture, the people that are in charge. If it's bad for them, it's bad. If it's good for them, it's good. But there are things that are good for the dominant will to power that might be bad for you. And that's what we call injustice. That's where you get the short end of the stick and you just get fucked over, and we say that it's good because exploiting you is good for their power. And the way we got to deal with that is Huey P. Newton said that you don't want to change power. What you want to do... I'm getting way too deep into too many different things. You want to negate the necessity of your existence. So the power, the will toward power, exists because there's a need that's being met. There's a way that you working for $11 an hour, not having enough to afford an apartment or a car, or having this really low quality of life, even though that's shit for you, it meets a need because it provides us with cheap labor, which is what the corporations, the will to power, needs to make a profit and continue to grow. So The way to change that is not to beg and plead for Burger King to give their employees more money, it's to find an alternative way of meeting the needs of the people. So the need is cheap labor. The alternative will probably, or is transitioning into AI and robots. Now this is going to create its own problems, because now you're replacing the workforce, and as much as they needed people to work for nothing, the people that work for nothing needed the money that they were getting. But you find an alternative way that to meet the need that negates the necessity of the problem. Right now, people working for nothing and have a very low quality of life is something that we need. But even our idea of what a low quality of life is actually phenomenally better than most of the rest of the world. You want to go back to those jungle people? There's a lot of variations between jungle people and us, where even though your life might be shit living in like a one bedroom fucking place taking the bus to work, if you have a roof over your head, if you have hot meals and food that's available anytime that you like, and TV and Netflix and a phone, those things that we take for granted are massive to the people that don't have them. Living in the hood is nowhere near as bad as living on the savannah. Not to say it's good, still has its problems, but we can't take for granted that our quality of life has been improving. Just the fact that we all have refrigeration. My grandparents didn't have fridges when they were kids. My grandmother, her idea of entertainment as a child was to go watch the blacksmith put shoes on a horse. It's two generations ago. My kid has his own iPad, so his quality of life is more convenient and entertaining, and it's going to be something he takes for granted, because just like we forgot about being hunters and gatherers, we forget about the time when we didn't have the internet. When did we start getting text messages? I don't remember when it happened. So Curio. let's go back to Huey. The reason you want to negate the necessity of your own existence, meaning you want to bring the people to power, not you, meaning you want to find an alternative way of meeting the need, not bring an organization to power, is that anything that is enlightening in its inception will eventually become restrictive in nature. So any organization or individual that props themselves up as the answer will eventually get to a place where the culture is going past where they're comfortable going. And so they're going to become more and more restrictive to try and cling on to the power that they have. And they're going to say, you got to do it our way or hit the highway. And they're going to eventually get overtaken by the culture. But in the meantime, they're going to make poor decisions and intentionally lie and be, you know, bureaucratic nightmares like Chernobyl and Russia and China. Wuhan! They're going to lie and deceive to hold on to their power, and that's how they become restrictive in nature and eventually make themselves outdated. All right, back to Curio for the third time. Control! So he has a short video and a long video. I recommend checking out all of his videos. You're going to love him and hate him, and he's going to make you feel some kind of way. He's provocative, which I like that more than I give a fuck about him being right or wrong. If he can help me learn something new, I'm gonna listen. So, within this game, Control, he was talking about the superstructure and objects of power. So, objects of power he defined as technologies of governance that relate to the system of control. Technologies of governance that relate to the system of control. Can you unpack that? They're ideas that are put into practice by the superstructure to realize goals. So they're technologies put into practice to meet the needs of the superstructure, or the dominant will to power is an easier way to say that. Materialism, modernity, a lot easier terminology than socio-political jargon like superstructure. The will to power puts technologies in place to help meet their needs. And they do that both directly and indirectly. So an example of directly that he uses is policy. There are rules to this game, to this dominant will to power. And these rules, these technologies, these laws, they're meant to help the dominant will to power hold on to its power and drive the mass of humans, all these Roop Scoots, in a singular direction, despite the fact that everybody wants to be an individual doing all this other different stuff. We're on a long enough curve, hopefully we're heading toward becoming a Type 1 civilization, but that's not something that has really been articulated. You should check out Andrew Yang's book, because that's basically all about the robots overtaking all of our job sectors. This is something that we're going to have to deal with in the immediate future. We're learning this with COVID, that we are going to have to transition away from the monetary system as we know it and use it. But that's a different conversation. So the superstructure, the dominant will to power, indirectly influences the people to do things to meet their goals through culture. And culture is a repetitive representation of what you can be. It's the propaganda. It's, you want to be your own man? All right, I'm going to give you 10,000 options through things that you can purchase, and you can mix and match all these things to be your own man. It's almost like in a video game, you get to choose your own skin and your own guns and really make up your character. Well, you're really making up your character of options that are provided for you. And so culture helps you stay on course for their goals by providing you with lots of options. Axe body spray, nice cars, you could be a libtard, you could be a Democrat, a Republican. It has lots of different roles that you can play and define yourself by. Because your self-value doesn't come from who you are, it comes from the identity that you assemble out of the options that are given to you. It's going to be a very dense podcast episode, and that's because we're going to be talking about Alan Watts' book, and it is extremely dense. And I'm going to be unpacking these ideas and thinking about them for a while. So one of the examples that Curio gave was he said that the state has a monopoly on violence. And the example being the state has the police. The police are in charge of keeping order, and they're allowed to have guns and they're allowed to shoot people. He says it's never okay for you and seven of your friends to tackle a cop, but it's always okay for a cop and seven of his other cops to tackle you or shoot you for no reason. That's monopoly on violence. That is a way in which they are set up above us. And when that monopoly on violence is used incorrectly, that's where we get injustice. That's where we get all of the race baiting politics that we're getting right now, and horrendous behavior where people are being killed for absolutely no reason. Now the problem with this is that what must be done to survive, to keep the game going, to work for the dominant will to power, sets us at war with reality. That injustice is a corruption that gets downloaded into us along with the best ideals and directives of the culture. And you like to think that it's kind of like your phone, where we're constantly getting updates, but there's corruption in the code, in the education, the teaching we've been getting, that is so old and so deeply entrenched in our way of doing things that we don't even recognize that there's a flaw in the way that we're perceiving reality. My example of that would be the agricultural revolution and the way we consume animals. I'm not a vegetarian, but it's like, it's horrifying to think of what we do to animals. Just, raised to be slaughtered. Billions of chickens a day. Millions of cows. Just raised, tortured, chopped up, eaten, as if they're not a living creature. And there may be other ways for us to meet those needs, that negate the necessity of the horrendous exploitation of animals, to at least give them a better quality of life or some quality of life before we kill them. All right, so now we're going to get into Alan Watts. Alan Watts is one of the guys I point to and I go, this Enlightenment stuff, he knows what he's talking about. Him and Ram Dass, and I haven't 100% synced up with either one of them, but both of them seem to have a lot more insight than other people I hear talking about it. Because the Enlightenment stuff, as I see it, just put my theory out there. we're just going to keep going over old information. My idea is that karma is basically how you react to your own thoughts and emotions. Karma is how you react to your own thoughts and emotions. So something happens, and if you have a positive reaction, no matter what it is, you have good karma. And if you have a negative reaction, no matter what it is, you have bad karma. So you've probably met people that everything in life seems to be working out with for them, and they're still miserable, depressed, angry, easily triggered, filled with early childhood trauma. That's bad karma. That's a lot of bad programming in their head that prevents them from being happy no matter what happens around them. And there are other people that are self-confident and tranquil, where even when bad stuff happens to them, they don't flinch, it doesn't bother them, they don't feel bad about it, they don't feel sad about it, they just take it in stride and continue going. That's good karma. So the way you bring karma to an end, the way you liberate yourself from samsara, is that you have to reprogram yourself to start meeting your negative thinking with positive karma. So it's a very long process, and it's, you know, as you, first you have to develop self-awareness of the fact that you're being triggered. So that means becoming cognizant and aware of the fact that you're upset when you're upset. And rather than feeling justified in your anger, anxiety, fear, depression, whatever it is, stop for a minute and just realize that you're in it. And then the next time you're in it, if you can catch yourself sooner, then start trying to do a mantra or do something to bring you back to your center, where instead of being affected by it and just going with the flow, stop and say, I'm just going to watch this happen, but I'm not going to allow myself to feel bad about this, or I'm not going to allow myself to misbehave because this is happening. And it takes about 30 days to produce a habit. The more and more you do this, the more and more you will get to a place where you're not triggered by so many things, where you're not constantly feeling anxiety or anger or depression, and you will bring your mind to a more centered place. Now, if you fill yourself with just joy, you end up with, you know, happy karma. Or if you can level it out, then you can end your karma and you can liberate yourself from the cycles of constantly, reenacting childhood traumas, reenacting bad thoughts and feelings that were put into you by the world chewing you up. And everybody gets chewed up. You might get raped, molested, beat up, abused, poverty. There's no limit to the ways the world can fuck you up, and you can't live in that pain forever. Certainly you can, but if you'd like to liberate yourself from that, it starts by retraining your mind to not react to everything with pain, fear, and anger. Replace it with joy. Replace it with lightness. Allow yourself to be free, to just exist. It's okay. You can let go. So, Alan Watts, I thought I had heard everything Alan Watts had ever had to say. A lot of people take his lectures and they put him up with music under it. He's a guy like Ram Dass, or the Mushroom Guy. I can't think of his name right now. Terrence McKenna. Where in the 60s and 70s, it was very popular for people to just go around lecturing with wild ideas. I wish there was more of that. Instead, we have Ben Shapiro. I want more Alan Watts people out there. That was the great hope for you, Joe Rogan, that maybe you and your DMT would be one of these guys, but you're just not. You just couldn't live up to it. So I have more or less thought that I'd heard everything Alan Watts has to say. And he got plenty to say, plenty to digest. And then I saw an audiobook available called Psychotherapy in the East and West. And I was like, all right, well, Alan, let's check this out. This is the most candid and behind the curtains he's ever been, because normally when you see him, he's dressed up like a Zen monk, he's got goofy Zen soy boy hair, and he's playing the part of the guru, which you don't know how, you're like, how enlightened were you died of alcoholism? And I don't think he was enlightened, but I do think he deeply understood all of these things on a level that hasn't been articulated by anybody else. So in this book, he breaks character, and he's not talking to you as a guru. He's talking to you very clinically about ideas of liberation and the similarities between psychotherapy and Vedanta or Hindu religions. And he's also talking about the limitations and the failings of both of these things, what they could learn from each other. It's about 5 hours long. At 3 hours, I had to stop. And there's going to be a clip at the end of this where I cut together a bunch of segments that I screen recorded. It's very dense. It's a lot to chew on. It's a lot to think about. Now, one of the central things that he's talking about is that in the Hindu world, religion and society and personal growth are all one interwoven thing. Whereas here in the West, we compartmentalize things. So psychotherapy is one thing, your religious beliefs are one thing, your political beliefs are one thing. And we don't think of that web as being interconnected. And he's, one of his criticisms of therapy is, he's like, you're trying to heal the mind, but you're separating the mind from all of the things that make the mind. All of the cultural influences that tell that person, this is who you are, this is why you have value, this is the role you can play within society. Now, those roles aren't natural. They're man-made and they're created by the will to power. So when the individual comes into conflict with the will to power on a psychological level, it can cause him to break down. When you go, I just can't fit in. I just don't work for any of this. I'm dyslexic. I can't spell, and I am terrible at grammar, and I'm terrible at math. So even though I'm kind of an intellectual, smart guy that reads a lot, there are limitations to what I can do because it's very difficult for me to operate within the educational system, because anything I write, they look at the spelling errors and the grammar errors, and it's laughable. I go, well, did a child come up with this? The ideas are interesting, but who wrote this? If you don't understand grammar, then you have no business being an anthropologist, which is what I went to school for. Did not finish. I'm one class shy of a bachelor's degree in anthropology. So in the Hindu religion, it's all kind of one interwoven thing. And he says, very, very forthright, he's like, all this mystical stuff, you know, monks floating, turning into lotuses, all the miracles. He's like, it's all hogwash. It's horseshit. What it is a very primitive form of psychotherapy. It's not primitive, it's actually very sophisticated, that is meant to help the individual function within society and liberate themselves from the injustice of society. It's built into the religion. The enlightenment stuff is how to free your mind from emotional baggage, from cultural damage, from whatever damage you have, so that you can still continue to be a healthy, happy individual despite the society or the will to power that's being built. It's almost like a checks and balances to help the society develop in a healthy way. And he said Buddhism isn't a religion, it's a reaction to or a revolutionary view. It's a cultural critique of Hinduism. So Buddhism is not a separate thing from Hinduism. Buddhism is a stripped down version of Hinduism, where Buddha is saying, like, he's actually focusing directly on the, you know, the psychotherapy or the liberation side of it. And he's leaving aside all of the mythologies and monkey gods and, you know, all that shit. If you get sucked into that too much, you're going to get lost in the weeds. The point is not, you know, who was the deity at the time, who's the most powerful deity that you can lay down and worship. The point is the enlightenment stuff. Now, I do believe that enlightenment, as I'm describing it, it's renunciation. It's turning, one path to get there is to turn your will over to something fully and wholly. So I think you could find liberation through any religion. You could find it through Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Mormonism, whatever you do. If you fully turn your will over to something, meaning, you know, somebody says something to you, rather than getting angry and being emotionally triggered, you turn all of your emotions over to God in complete devotion. Every moment of your life becomes you being a representation of God and God's love. If you can do that, if you can train your mind to be that in love with God, you will have liberation from emotional baggage, worry about the world. Everything will be in God's hands. You'll be able to function happily and playfully. All right, So Alan Watts. The things that someone who's trying to liberate you is trying to heal are social and interpersonal. The failing of therapy is that it focuses too much on interpersonal and not enough, or not at all, on social. We want to change the way that we interpret and interact with the world. So, you know, creating this sense of self, you know, all this meditation horseshit they're always telling you, like, see the feeling. There is depression. There is anger. Well, those are triggered emotions that are affecting the way you interpret the world. Or is the Bhagavad Gita? No, the Upanishads. So the Upanishads put it. You know, your thoughts and feelings can be like horses that are running wild that have never had a bit in their mouth. And by developing a sense of self and learning to manage your own thoughts and emotions and manage your own reaction to those things, you can put a bit in their mouth and you can start leading them where you want to go rather than having them drag you all over the place. I wrote down, the individual is an intellectual dodge. I think that means the individual, meaning separating yourself from all the causes and effect that interplay and intermingle to affect the way you see the world. You know, there have been countless videos about how Facebook is designed to trigger your dopamine receptors and to reward you the same way, you know, Vegas slot machines are set up. And the same thing goes for all this freemium downloadable content, like The Simpsons and fucking Pokemon Go and South Park and the 8 million other games that are free to download. But then you hit a moment where it's like, well, if you'd like to progress, you can spend real world money, or you can farm it out and do really boring, tedious work. That's a manipulation to get you invested in developing something, and they're playing. they're seeing if you have the patience to grind it out. And then within video games, you know, you have your get all these achievements, and it makes you feel like you've accomplished something on a neurological or chemical level, but really you haven't accomplished anything. It's talking about loops or patterns. We all exist in this very small world where we're really just, you know, you're just a guy sitting on the couch. That was something from an episode of Mark Maron. He called one of his buddies, like, freaking out with an existential dilemma or heartbreak or something, and his buddy was like, Mark, you're a dude sitting on a couch. You're just a dude sitting on the couch. And sometimes you gotta be that reductive to not get so caught up in all the games and politics of the world that's trying to get you dopamine addicted and sex addicted and entertainment addicted and all these ways to avoid being with yourself so that you stay invested in the game and stay invested in the dominant will to power. But that investment in getting your worth from those things is causing neuroses, and that's why people are psychologically breaking down and shooting up schools and developing prejudice. That's the baseline to all bad thought. To go back to the Enlightenment thing, you know, people think like, oh, Enlightenment means you no longer have any feelings. Like, oh, so you just become a sociopath. No. the basic self is kind of like a child that just looks at the world and is just filled with wonder and love and compassion. And the more you retrain your mind with good karma, the more every moment of your existence is a fulfilling view of the world as something special that's going on that you get to be part of. The other day, my wife took my son for a walk, and there's some rocks outside. So usually I'll hold his hand and he'll climb up the rocks and jump off. Well, there was some smaller boulders next to the bigger boulders, and he walked up to the small ones, and he knelt down and he patted them on the head, and he went, oh, look, cute little ones. That is beautiful. That is the most, like, pure view of the world. He understands the concept of, like, adult and child being the same thing, and he projected that onto rocks, and it was fucking adorable. not that you want to, you know, take your mind to a place where you're, you know, absurdly looking at the world. You can still take all of the most constructive thoughts to deconstruct and analyze the reality, but there doesn't have to be any tension with reality. You can just simply be part of it. You don't have to separate yourself from reality. You are part of reality. But we set ourselves at war with reality by playing into these patterns that set us at war with ourselves, and by developing all of these bad habits that become horses that are running wild. And then we're like, I don't know why I'm depressed. I don't know. It's because you don't have a fulfilling interior life or sense of self, and instead you live at the whim and behest of entertainment, emotions, and the opportunities that are in front of you. You got to get liberated from all of it, and then you can do it. Then you can play the game. So liberation from social conditioning includes liberation from the hatred for conditioning. This is an important thing, and a hard and mature pill to swallow. So say we'll take black people being mad about slavery, and it sucks that I'm a white guy talking about this, blah blah blah, white guilt. You can't harbor hatred for the conditioning forever, because the hatred is a form of bondage. It's a way of holding yourself to bad and negative feelings, and at some point you have to process through and not be mad at the conditioning. You just have to accept that it was and move on to what is or what is going to be. Now, obviously, we haven't worked out all the things. I'm not just saying, hey, black people, just, suck it up and be okay with it. That's not what I'm saying. But as an example, it's not enough to, take the agricultural revolution. A lot of people read Ishmael and then they want to run off and join a tribe and be tribal people because it's a more sacred, beautiful way of life. It's a miserable fucking way of life. But realizing that our culture is predicated on preying on the earth and transforming it into whatever we want and treating it like shit and basically raping the environment and animals, once you realize that you've been conditioned to do that, you can't be resentful of the fact that you were conditioned, because that's a distraction and a pain that you will harbor that will prevent you from moving forward and actually changing things or doing good or enjoying life. And it's like, you can make yourself miserable if you want to, but that's all you're doing is making yourself miserable. You're not actually changing things. Unless, of course, you take your loop, your pattern, and you construct it in a way that you are actively coming into conflict with power. It's all looping around. That word loop, I've heard it in several interviews. 50 Cent is doing interviews for his book, and he's basically regurgitating 90% of the book in these interviews. And he used the word loop. Somebody else did as well. I think it's because Westworld is out. That's probably where I got the idea from. I have not seen season 3, but I hear it's terrible and super SJW. It has no solution until you realize it's nonsense. You don't kill the ego, you see through it. You already are it. So my enlightenment experience was that I had a complete mental break and I shot off into outer space and I was a star floating through space. It was an experience I had. Could have just been a psychological break, chemicals in the brain, massive hallucination, or it could have actually happened. Either way, that gave me a perspective to see that nothing mattered. I didn't have to be afraid of death because I still existed. And not only did I still exist, everybody that I knew and loved still existed. So I didn't have to worry about anything that happened on Earth, because no matter how bad it is, those people would eventually die and return to their eternal perfect form. And so none of the pain of the world actually matters. And so you could let go of all of it. And I realized I didn't have to be affected by things. If you want to take that to its extreme conclusion, if you want to be a Buddha, it's like, they'll be like, well, where is the enlightenment in if you're being raped? Well, even in that situation, there's a piece of God there. And that piece of God is you, a soul, an eternal being. And it doesn't matter what's happening to that physical form, because nothing can actually hurt, tarnish, or change the eternal you, the essence of you that actually exists. Now, it's very hard to say that to someone going through it. Well, I certainly hope you wouldn't say it while you're doing that to someone, but like, to the victim of that, to a victim of that level of abuse and trauma, it's very difficult to say, like, you can let go, it's okay, you're still perfect and eternal, because it feels like you're invalidating their pain, and they feel like they've earned their pain, but that is clinging to the hatred. And eventually, if you want to be a healthy, happy person, you have to let go of the hatred, no matter how unbelievably awful or traumatic it actually was. You don't kill the trauma, you see through the trauma. Alright, I think I'm going to wrap it up here. I'm going to be talking about this stuff for the next several weeks. And I'm going to put some snippets of the Alan Watts book at the end of this to listen to. Along with my space music. So you can say la pause and meditate on liberation. I have a quote in here. The mind is socially constituted. And that's a double bind. Society says the mind is in the skin, independent, self-determining, according to the rules. Rules give and take independence. Society does not allow from withdrawal. So I believe that's in the clip you're going to hear at the end. Part of the reason that we have so many people having psychological breakdowns is that we tell people, you are an independent person and you can do as you like. But you can do as you like within the structure that is set up by the dominant will to power. But we don't ever talk about what that is putting into your head. We just take that as base reality. And so when your mind comes into conflict with base reality, that's when you have psychological breakdowns. So we tell you to be independent, but independent within the rules that we've set up for you. And then we also will not allow you to withdraw from the game because, well, at this point, there is no withdrawing unless you want to be homeless. We've pervaded the earth. And that's not a bad thing. As I said before, we have raised the quality of life. There's less murder, less slavery, less sexual abuse, meaning like sex trafficking, even though there's a lot of that. It's a lot less than the Mongols coming in, killing all the men and boys and raping all the women and then making them slaves. Way better quality of life for the species on the whole. The species, I believe, is technologically advancing. It's possible at some point we'll be able to put a consciousness in a computer or develop a computer with consciousness, and that will give us unlimited computing power to go through the problems of the world and to be able to hold multiple complex ideas in mind at one time and then sort them out to their rudimentary source. And then that's when we'll start developing as a culture, because once we have the mind to solve the problems, then the dominant will to power will begin, I believe in theory, to start collectively moving the species toward the answers to those problems. And that's when we'll become a type 1 civilization and, you know, leave the earth, and you'll have multiple realities. You'll have base reality, the physical reality, and then you'll have this other plane of the computer plane, and there might be multiple planes of existence within there. My buddy Vlad had a cool idea called novelty farming. It's his idea for an episode of Black Mirror, where he's like, imagine if you could create a universe from scratch within VR, and then whatever naturally evolves, you take the best things from their culture, the best ideas, music, best novelty, and you pull it out and you bring that to base reality. Well, you can have millions of farms, you know, theoretically running at the same time and just pulling all of the best things from all of the different multi-dimensions into one dimension that basically becomes heaven. Or eventually, you know, all of the matter and energy come together and negate the necessity of their own existence. And before the eye of the Buddha closes, it flicks a little piece of existence out and starts the whole process over again. Guys, this has been weird. But smoke something, drink something, think about liberation, and I'll holler at you next week. We might talk about 50 Cent next week, and then I'll come back to this, but I'm going to be coming back to this a lot, as it feels like a lot of the pieces of the puzzle are starting to come together. One more quick plug. With apologies, this Sunday is not going to be at its normal time. Me and Ross Dog are going to be on the Real Ass Podcast. We're going to try and have some crazy adventures. I got a whole bunch of ideas to make Lewis squirm and worm and have some fun. And then after that show, Ross and I will come back and we'll do a recap and talk to everybody. And then I'm sure Cosmic will do another show after that. Shout out to Cosmic Cam. There's a whole bunch of drama going on in the RDA around this lady, Lady Marmalade. That's an entire podcast all in and of itself. But go subscribe to the Ross Dog channel and you can check out videos exonerating us and seeing how we are now going to war with the entire true crime community because of a troll that was played probably by Jiminam. I'm not going to point the finger at him yet, but his fingerprints are all over this. This seems like one of his trolls. And boy, oh boy, did it work, because everybody got sucked up into it. Lady Marmalade, if you're listening, condolences, get off the fucking internet. Be an adult, get off the internet. And all you other vampires that are trying to get clicks and views off of this, you disgust me. Shout out to the Ian Ellis LLC, got some new videos up there. We got a comment from Von DeClarlo this week. Von is on to us. We got some people checking out the Dante doc, the old one. They don't seem to understand that it's a mockumentary. It's supposed to be funny. They're expecting a full-on expose of Dante. And I guess Dante was on a show, and he said, the Cult of Black Phillip should only... Not the Cult of Black Phillip. Yeah, the Black Phillip show, it was only meant for entertainment purposes. Yeah, we didn't mean the things we said because Patrice was angry. Yeah, I'm just a cartoon character. Yeah. Dante, we're very disappointed. We'll see. A lot going on. Stay tuned to the RDA LLC, and I'll figure all of that stuff out at some point. All right, guys. Thank you for sticking around. Thank you for listening to the podcast. A lot of new people out there. Thank you guys for joining. The podcast, normally I go out and I do stand-up comedy, and you get 5 minutes of new material each week and then some thoughts about comedy or what it is I'm talking about. No comedy right now, so we're just chewing up intellectual ideas. If you're looking for just straight up funny with apologies, would be the show to watch. That's where we just goof around and have fun. My private little podcast can tend to be a little bit more serious. Just because I like finding interesting ideas to think about. All right, y'all. Deuces.
It means that he has to help the individual in liberating himself from various forms of social conditioning, which includes liberation from hating this conditioning, hatred being a form of bondage to its object. For they are dealing with people whose distress arises from what may be termed Maya, to use the Hindu-Buddhist word, whose exact meaning is not merely illusion, but the entire world conception of a culture, considered as illusion in the strict etymological sense of a play, Latin lude. The aim of a way of liberation is not the destruction of Maya, but seeing it for what it is, or seeing through it. Play is not to be taken seriously, or in other words, ideas of the world and of oneself, which are social conventions and institutions, are not to be confused with reality. His state of consciousness, his very feeling of existence. What is more, it provides the human organism's idea of its individuality, which can take a number of quite different forms. Seeing this, the psychotherapist must realize that his science or art is misnamed, for he is dealing with something far more extensive than a psyche and its private troubles. This is just what so many psychotherapists are recognizing, and what, at the same time, makes the Eastern ways of liberation so pertinent to their work. For they are dealing with people whose distress arises from what may be termed Maya, to use the Hindu-Buddhist word, whose exact meaning is not merely illusion, but the entire world conception of a culture, considered as illusion in the strict etymological sense of a play, Latin lude. The aim of a way of liberation is not the destruction of Maya, but seeing it for what it is, or seeing through it. Play is not to be taken seriously, or in other words, ideas of the world and of oneself, which are social conventions and institutions, are not to be confused with reality. The rules of communication are not necessarily the rules of the universe, and man is not the role or identity which society thrusts upon him. For when a man no longer confuses himself with the definition of himself that others have given him, he is at once universal and unique. He is universal by virtue of the inseparability of his organism from the cosmos. He is unique in that he is just this organism, and not any stereotype of role, class, or identity assumed for the convenience of social communication. A language would be greatly enriched by making it easier for us to understand relationships which our present languages conceal. Described simply as pattern in motion, the mystery of what acts and what is acted upon, of how the cause issues in the effect, would be as easy as seeing the relationship between the concave and convex sides of a curve. Which side comes first? The difficulty, however, is not so much in finding the language as in overcoming social resistance. Would it really do to find out that our game is not serious, that enemies are friends, and that the good thrives on the evil? Society as we know it seems to be a tacit conspiracy to keep this hushed up, for fear that the contest will otherwise cease. If these opposites are not kept fiercely separate and antagonistic, what motivation will there be for the creative struggle between them? If man does not feel himself at war with nature, will there be any further impetus to technological progress? Imagine how the Christian conscience would react to the idea that behind the scenes, God and the devil were the closest friends, but had taken opposite sides in order to stage a great cosmic game. Yet this is rather much how things stood when the book of Job was written. For here Satan is simply the counsel for the prosecution in the court of heaven, as faithful a servant of the court as the Advocatus Diaboli at the Vatican. The problem is, of course, that if men are patterns of action and not agents, and if the individual in the world act with each other mutually, so that action does not originate in either, who is to be blamed when things go wrong? Can the police then come around asking, who started this? The convention of the individual as the responsible, independent agent is basic to almost all our social and legal structures. Acceptance of this role or identity is the chief criterion of sanity, and we feel that if anyone is reducible to actions or behaviors with nobody doing them, he must be no more than a soulless mechanism. Indeed, there is at first glimpse an element of terror. In practice, it happens that just as soon as one gets used to this feeling and is not afraid of it, it is possible to go on behaving as rationally as ever, but with a remarkable sense of lightness. Setting aside, for the time being, the moral and ethical implications of this view of man, it seems to have the same sort of advantage over the ordinary view that the Copernican solar system has over the Ptolemaic. It is so much simpler, even though it means giving up the central position of the Earth. This is, moreover, the kind of simplicity which is fruitful rather than diminishing. It leads to further possibilities of play, greater richness of articulation. On the other hand, the ordinary conventional view seems increasingly to fail in what it purports to achieve. First, liberation is not revolution. It is not going out of one's way to disturb the social order by casting doubt upon the unconventional ideas by which people hold together. Furthermore, society is always insecure, and thus hostile to anyone who challenges its conventions directly. To disabuse oneself of accepted mythologies without becoming the victim of other people's anxiety requires considerable tact. Second, the whole technique of liberation requires that the individual shall find out the truth for himself. Simply to tell it is not convincing. Instead, he must be asked to experiment, to act consistently upon assumptions which he holds to be true, until he finds out otherwise. The guru or teacher of liberation must therefore use all his skill to persuade the student to act upon his own delusions, for the latter will always resist any undermining of the props of his security. He teaches not by explanation, but by pointing out new ways of acting upon the student's false assumptions, until the student convinces himself that they are false. Herein, I feel, is the proper explanation of the esotericism of the ways of liberation. The initiate is one who knows that certain social institutions are self-contradictory or in actual conflict with the form of nature. But he knows also that these institutions have the strongest emotions invested in them. They are the rules of communication whereby people understand one another. And they have been beaten into the behavior patterns of impressionable children with the full force of social anxiety. At the same time, those who are taken in by such institutions are suffering from them, suffering from the very ideas which they believe to be vital to sanity and survival. There is therefore no way of disabusing the sufferer directly by telling him that his cherished disease is a disease. If he is to be helped at all, he must be tricked into insight. If I am to help someone else to see that a false problem is false, I must pretend that I am taking his problem seriously. What I am actually taking seriously is his suffering, but he must be led to believe that it is what he considers as his problem. Such trickery is basic to medicine and psychotherapy alike. It has been said that the good doctor is one who keeps the patient amused while nature works the cure. This is not always true, but it is a sound general principle. It is easier to wait for a natural change when one is given the impression that something is being done to bring it about. What is being done is the trick. The relaxed and rested waiting is the actual cure. But the anxiety which attends a disease makes direct and deliberate relaxation almost impossible. Patients lose confidence in their doctors to the extent that the trickery is exposed, and therefore, the art of medicine progresses by the invention of new and ever more impenetrable tricks. Let us suppose, then, that someone who is suffering from a social institution imagines that he is suffering because of an actual conflict in life, in the very structure of the physical world, that nature threatens his presumably physical ego. The healer must then appear to be a magician, a master of the physical world. He must do whatever is necessary to convince the sufferer that he can solve what seems to be the latter to be a physical problem. There is no other way of convincing him to do what is necessary for acting consistently upon his false assumption. He must above all convince the sufferer that he, the guru, has mastered the imaginary problem, that his ego is not disturbed by pain or death or worldly passions. His liberating recognition between those who are liberated, a Zen Buddhist text says, when two thieves meet, they need no introduction. They recognize each other without question. Of course, the guru is human like everyone else. His advantage, his liberation, lies in the fact that he is not in conflict with himself for being so. He is not in the double bind of pretending that he is an independent agent without knowing that he is pretending, of imagining that he is an ego or subject which can somehow manage to be permanently one up on its correlative object. The changing panorama of experiences, sensations, feelings, emotions, and thoughts. The guru accepts himself. More exactly, he does not think of himself as something other than his behavior patterns, as something which performs them. On the other hand, social conditioning as we know it depends entirely on persuading people not to accept themselves, and necessary as this stratagem, this as-if, may be for training the young, it is a fiction of limited use. The more it succeeds, the more it fails. Civilization attained at the price of inculcating this friction permanently is necessarily self-destructive, and by comparison with such disaster, the guru's dishonesty is a positive virtue. A Japanese coastal village was once threatened by a tidal wave, but the wave was sighted in advance, far out on the horizon, by a lone farmer in the rice fields on the hillside above the village. At once he set fire to the fields, and the villagers who came swarming up to save their crops were saved from the flood. His crime of arson is like the trickery of the guru, the doctor, or the psychotherapist in persuading people to try to solve a false problem by acting consistently upon its premises. This apparently unorthodox account of the basic method of the ways of liberation is required, I feel, to explain a number of problems. However various their doctrines and however different their formal techniques, all seem to culminate in the same state or mode of consciousness in which the duality of the ego and the world is overcome. Call it cosmic consciousness or mystical experience, a critique of culture, an enduring non-violent revolution or loyal opposition to the culture with which it is involved. This gives these ways of liberation something in common with psychotherapy, beyond the interest in changing states of consciousness. For the task of the psychotherapist is to bring about a reconciliation between individual feeling and social norms without, however, sacrificing the integrity of the individual. He tries to help the individual to be himself and to go it alone without giving unnecessary offense to his community, to be in the world of social convention, but not of the world. A Chinese Buddhist text describes the sage in words that strongly suggest Reisman's inner-directed or Maslow's self-actualizing personality. It means that he has to help the individual in liberating himself from various forms of social conditioning, which includes liberation from hating this conditioning, hatred being a form of bondage to its object. But from this point of view, the troubles and symptoms from which the patient seeks relief and the unconscious factors behind them cease to be merely psychological. They lie in the whole pattern of his relationships with other people, and more particularly, in the social institutions by which these relationships are governed, the rules of communication employed by the culture or group. These include the conventions of language and law, of ethics and aesthetics, of status, role and identity, and of cosmology, philosophy and religion. For this whole social complex is what provides the individual's conception of himself, his state of consciousness, his very feeling of existence. What is more, it provides the human organism's idea of its individuality, which can take a number of quite different forms. Seeing this, The psychotherapist must realize that his science or art is misnamed, for he is dealing with something far more extensive than a psyche and its private troubles. This is just what so many psychotherapists are recognizing, and what, at the same time, makes the Eastern ways of liberation so pertinent to their work. For they are dealing with people whose distress arises from what may be termed Maya, to use the Hindu-Buddhist word, whose exact meaning is not merely illusion, but the entire world conception of a culture, considered as illusion in the strict etymological sense of a play, Latin lude. The aim of a way of liberation is not the destruction of Maya, but seeing it for what it is, or seeing through it. Play is not to be taken seriously, or in other words, ideas of the world and of oneself, which are social conventions and institutions, are not to be confused with reality. The rules of communication are not necessarily the rules of the universe, and man is not the role or identity which society thrusts upon him. For when a man no longer confuses himself with the definition of himself that others have given him, he is at once universal and unique. He is universal by virtue of the inseparability of his organism from the cosmos. He is unique in that he is just this organism, and not any stereotype of role, class, or identity assumed for the convenience of social communication. There are many reasons why distress comes from confusing this social mire with reality. There is direct conflict between what the individual organism is and what others say it is and expect it to be. The rules of social communication often contain contradictions, which lead to impossible dilemmas in thought, feeling, and action. Or it may be that confusion of oneself with a limiting and impoverished view of one's role or identity creates feelings of isolation, loneliness, and alienation. The multitudinous differences between individuals and their social contexts lead to as many ways of seeking relief from these conflicts. Some seek it in the psychoses and neuroses which lead to psychiatric treatment, but for the most part, release is sought in the socially permissible orgies of mass entertainment, religious fanaticism, chronic sexual titillation, alcoholism, war, the whole sad list of tedious and barbarous escapes. Naturally, then, it is being said that the need for psychotherapy goes far beyond that of those who are clinically psychotic or neurotic, and for many years now, increasing numbers of people have been receiving psychotherapy who would formerly have sought counsel from a minister of religion or a sympathetic friend. But no one has yet discovered how to apply psychotherapy on a mass basis. Trained therapists exist in a ratio of about 1 to 8,000 of the population, and the techniques of psychotherapy are lengthy and expensive. Its growing popularity is due in large measure to the prestige of science, and thus of the therapist, as a scientific rather than religious soul doctor. Yet I know of a few reputable psychiatrists who will not admit, at least in private, that their profession is still far from being a science. To begin with, there is no generally accepted theory or even terminology of the science, but rather a multiplicity of conflicting theories and divergent techniques. Our knowledge of neurology, if this should prove to be the basis of psychiatry, is what I have called the skin-encapsulated ego, the separate soul and its fleshy vehicle together constituting a personality which is unique and ultimately valuable in the sight of God. This view is undoubtedly the historical basis of the Western style of individuality, giving us the sensation of ourselves as isolated islands of consciousness, confronted with objective experiences which are quite other. We have developed this sensation to a particularly acute degree, but the system of conventions which inculcates this sensation also requires this definitively isolated ego to act as the member of a body and to submit without reserve to the social pattern of the church. The tension so generated, however interesting at times, is in the long run as unworkable as any other flat self-contradiction. It is a perfectly ideal context for breeding psychosis. Yet, as we shall see, it would also be an ideal context for therapy if responsible religious leaders were aware of the contradiction and did not take it seriously. In other words, the minister might become an extraordinarily helpful person if he could see through his own religion. But his training and his economic situation do not encourage him to do so, and therefore the psychotherapist is in a more advantageous position. The positive aspect of liberation, as is understood in the Eastern ways, is precisely freedom of play. Its negative aspect is criticism of premises and rules of the social game, which restrict this freedom and do not allow what we have called fruitful development. The Buddhist nirvana is defined as release from samsara, literally the round of birth and death, that is, from life lived in a vicious circle, as an endlessly repetitious attempt to solve a false problem. Samsara is therefore comparable to attempts to square the circle, trisect the angle, or construct a mechanism of perpetual motion. A puzzle which has no solution forces one to go over the same ground again and again, until it appears that the question which it poses is nonsense. This is why the neurotic person keeps repeating his behavior patterns, always unsuccessful because he is trying to solve a false problem, to make sense of a self-contradiction. If he cannot see that the problem itself is nonsense, he may simply retreat into psychosis, into the paralysis of being unable to act at all. Alternatively, the psychotic break may also be an illegitimate burst into free play out of sheer desperation, not realizing that the problem is impossible not because of overwhelming difficulty, but because it is meaningless. If, then, there is to be fruitful development in the science of psychotherapy, as well as in the lives of those whom it intends to help, it must be released from the unconscious blocks, unexamined assumptions, and unrealized nonsense problems which lie in its social context. Again, one of the most powerful instruments for this purpose is intercultural comparison, especially with highly complex cultures like the Chinese and Indian, which have grown up in relative isolation from our own, and especially with attempts that have been made within those cultures to find liberation from their own patterns. It is hard to imagine anything more constructive to the psychotherapist than the opportunity which this affords. Similarly, to say that we always choose what we prefer says no more than that we always choose what we choose. If there is a basic urge to live, there must also, as Freud thought, be a basic urge to die. But language and thought are cleaner without these ghostly instincts, urges, and necessities. As Wittgenstein says, a necessity for one thing to happen because another has happened does not exist. There is only logical necessity. An enduring organism is simply one that is consistent with its environment. Its climate and its food agree with it. Its pattern assimilates them. Eliminating what does not agree, and this consistent motion, this transformation of food and air into the pattern of the organism, is what we call its existence. There is no mysterious necessity for this to continue or discontinue. To say that the organism needs food is only to say that it is food. To say that it eats because it is hungry is only to say that it eats when it is ready to eat. To say that it dies because it cannot find food is only another way of saying that its death is the same thing as its ceasing to be consistent with the environment. The so-called causal explanation of an event is only the description of the same event in other words. To quote Wittgenstein again, at the basis of the whole modern view of the world lies the illusion that the so-called laws of nature are the explanations of natural phenomena. More complex organisms, such as human beings, are more complex consistencies, more complex transformations of the environment. Not only are they patterns of transforming food, but their agreement or consistency with the environment changes nuclear vibrations into sound and light, weight and color, taste and smell, temperature and texture, until finally they generate elaborate patterns of signs and symbols of great interior consistency. When these mesh with the environment, it becomes possible to describe the world in terms of sign patterns. The world is thus transformed into thought in the same way that food was transformed into body. The agreement or consistency of body pattern or thought pattern with the pattern of the world goes on as long as it goes on. To say why it starts or stops is only to describe particular consistencies or inconsistencies. To say that there is no necessity for things to happen as they do is perhaps another way of saying that the world is play. But this idea is an affront to common sense because the basic rule of human societies is that one must be consistent. If you want to belong to our society, you must play our game, or simply, if we are going to be consistent, we must be consistent. The conclusion is substituted for the premise. But this is understandable because, as we have seen, human society is so complex and volatile that consistency is difficult to maintain. Children keep slipping out of the patterns of behavior that we try to impose upon them, and for this and similar reasons, our social conventions have to be maintained by force. The first rule of the game, put in another way, is that the game must continue, that the survival of the society is necessary. But we must not lose sight of the fact that the consistencies or regularities of nature are patterns that do occur, not patterns that must occur. Natural events do not obey commandments in the same way that human beings obey the law. Or, put in still other words, The first rule of the game is that this game is serious, i.e., is not a game. This might be called the primordial repression. By this I do not mean that it is an event at the temporal beginnings of human life, but rather that it may be our most deeply ingrained social attitude. But just as soon as we feel that certain things, such as survival, are serious necessities, life becomes problematic in a very special sense, quite different from, say, the problems of chess or of science. Life and problem become the same. The human situation becomes a predicament for which there is no solution. Man then behaves as a self-frustrating organism, and this behavior can be seen in many different ways. For example, one of our greatest assets for survival is our sense of time, our marvelously sensitive memory, which enables us to predict the future from the pattern of the past. Yet awareness of time ceases to be an asset when concern for the future makes it almost impossible to live fully in the present, or when increasing knowledge of the future makes it increasingly certain that beyond a brief span we have no future. If, too, man's growing sensitivity requires that he become more and more aware of himself as an individual, if social institutions are designed more and more to foster the unique person, not only are we in great danger of overpopulating, but also we are betting and concentrating upon man in his most vulnerable and impermanent form. This self-frustrating activity is samsara, the vicious circle from which the ways of liberation propose release. Release depends upon becoming aware of that primordial repression which is responsible for the feeling that life is a problem, that it is serious, that it must go on. It has to be seen that the problem we are trying to solve is absurd. But this means far more than mere resignation of fate, far more than the stoic despair of recognizing that human life is a losing battle with the chaos of nature. That would amount only to seeing that the problem has no solution. We should then simply withdraw from it and sit aloof in a kind of collective psychosis. The point is not that the problem has no solution, but that it is so meaningless that it need not be felt as a problem. To quote Wittgenstein again, for an answer which cannot be expressed, the question too cannot be expressed. The riddle does not exist. If a question can be put at all, then it can also be answered. For doubt can only exist when there is a question only where there is an answer, and this only where something can be said. We feel that even if all possible scientific questions be answered, the problems of life have still not been touched at all. Of course, there is then no question left, and just this is the answer. The solution of the problem of life is seen in the vanishing of this problem. Is not this reason why men to whom after long doubting the sense of life became clear, could not then say wherein this sense consisted? When a psychiatrist asked a Zen master how he dealt with neurotic people, he replied, "I trap them." "And just how do you trap them?" "I get them where they can't ask any more questions." But the idea that human life need not be felt as a problem is so unfamiliar and seemingly implausible that we must go more deeply into the social origins of the problematic feeling. In the first place, the opposition of human order to natural chaos is false. To say that there is no natural necessity is not to say that there is no natural order, no pattern or consistency in the physical world. After all, man himself is part of the physical world, and so is his logic. But it should not be hard to see that the kind of order which we call logical or causal necessity is a subtype of order